Welcome, everyone. This is Diana Oblinger, President and CEO of EDUCAUSE, and you're participating in day two of the 2013 EDUCAUSE Sprint. Now, a sprint is an intense online global community event. We've got about 1,200 people registered, and we've got people registered from all states in the United States as well as 34 different countries. I know I saw Marcel from the Netherlands earlier, a colleague from just outside of Melbourne, Australia. So to all of you, welcome. Now, as you may know, the sprint is intended to focus on an important topic, and we do that over 3 days through webinars, blogs, idea scale, voting, polls, social media, lots of resources that you can find on the website. So remember to go to the sprint website because that's the place you will find links to all of that information. Now, this year's sprint uses MOOCs as a starting point, but only a starting point, to explore the transformations that we think are underway in education, what we have tended to think about as our evolution from the information age to the connected age. On day one of the sprint, we took a broad overview of the topic, and today we'll be focusing on how technology can change pedagogy. And what we intend to do is examine how technology impacts the teaching and learning experience, both for students and for faculty. And we'll also take a look at the latest data that we've got on e-learning. Then day three, tomorrow, we're going to explore the complex infrastructure that's required to support the connected age. Now, we couldn't do this without sponsors. The 2013 EDUCAUSE Sprint is sponsored by Acquia and Blink Reaction, and they help colleges and universities create sophisticated knowledge management platforms with Drupal to improve the user experience, security, performance, and scalability. So thank you to our sponsors. Now, most of you are probably familiar with the website interface that we've got, and let me encourage you to make this an interactive webinar. Five quick notes on the interface. The first one is there's a chat box on the left-hand side of your screen where you can share comments and resources. There's a separate chat box on the right hand below the slides where we'd like you to enter questions. So if you'd keep your comments and sharing of resources in that left pod, we'll be looking specifically in that lower right hand pod for questions to ask our speakers. Now, also at the bottom of the screen is an open captions box, and that's a new accessibility feature. You can change the font size displayed in the chat, question, or caption boxes by clicking on the lines, either to the right or left of the chat or the up-down arrows in the captioning. Now, one other new thing for this year is we've got a visual recorder. And during the question and answer periods and at the end of our session, you'll see a visual representation of our discussion that will be displayed on your screen. You'll be able to see the whole thing in time lapse in a movie that we'll post after the webinar is over. But you'll see that visual facilitation a couple of times during the session today. Now, if you experience any technical difficulties, there is a technical help box in the lower left-hand corner, so just type a message in there and we will get right back to you. Now, those of you who would like to back channel by tweeting, the hashtag is EDUSprint, EDUSprint. And of course, the polls, the session slides, the entire thing will be archived and available later on today on the website. And I'll start out with a quick question for you, and that is to ask you what you hope to gain from today's sprint. So take a moment and give us your thoughts about what you would like to gain today. Now let me turn more directly to today's sprint. What we're going to do is explore how large-scale, data-supported online learning can change the learning experience. It can also change what a classroom might be in a blended environment. And what we hope to do is also help dispel some of the hype and hysteria that's around MOOCs with some of the latest data. We'll explore whether MOOCs, online and blended courses really represent a threat to higher education. And as someone who teaches disruptive technologies, our first speaker will talk about the survivor model and confessions of a MOOC man, as he's called himself sometimes. And he's also someone who is teaching MOOCs, not just teaching about disruptive technology. So you'll hear him talk about the threat, the opportunity, and how we morph our notions of education. Our second speaker is going to explore how online tools enable access anytime, anywhere for simulations, for instantaneous feedback and interaction, and asks questions about can we create an intellectual environment that is even more intense than the traditional classroom and acquire not just new knowledge, but new perspective based on a global cohort. He'll also ask what we are learning through MOOCs that's able to improve learning, not just automate it. Mm-hmm. And finally, Susan Grajak, our third presenter, will share results of our State of the E-Learning Research Study. You'll learn who's interested in e-learning and whether or not they're using MOOCs. She'll also provide information on how our institutions are managing e-learning and share a maturity model. So joining us today are Hank Lucas, Eric Grimson, and Susan Grajak. And I'll tell you about each one very briefly. Hank Lucas is the Professor of Information Systems at the University of Maryland, College Park. His research interests include information technology-enabled transformations of organizations, of markets, industries, and, of course, our daily lives. He's authored a number of publications on the impact of technology. And you might be interested to know that he co-wrote and co-produced a documentary called The Transformation Age, Surviving a Technology Revolution that was played on PBS. He also teaches a MOOC. Our second speaker is Eric Grimson, who served as the chancellor at MIT since 2011 and is a professor of computer science and engineering at MIT since 1984. Eric is the Bernard Gordon Professor of Medical Engineering and has served as the head of the Department for Electrical Engineering and Computer Science. Some of you may know Eric because he is internationally recognized for his research in computer vision, particularly in applications of medical image analysis. He's got a host of honors to his credit, an award for excellence in teaching. He's a fellow of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence and also a fellow of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. And our third speaker is Susan Grajak, Educause's Vice President for Data Research and Analytics. Before joining Educause a couple of years ago, Susan spent about 25 years at Yale University in information technology services. She created and led the IT research department in the School of Medicine and also held a faculty appointment in the School of Medicine. Her expertise encompasses the design and execution of research in management, the behavioral sciences, public policy, as well as statistical analysis. And most of you, of course, know Susan as someone who puts together these wonderful ECAR studies that help us understand the state of the art and the state of our profession. So, enough with the introductions. Let me turn it over to Hank. Hank, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you all for listening in today. I enjoy very much having the opportunity to talk about MOOCs and online education in general. So what we're going to discuss today is both my experience in giving a MOOC, but also the question of whether or not the current model of higher education is going to be able to survive MOOCs and online learning. I like to start with an example that's not really from universities, but maybe suggests some things that could happen. And I'll ask you, what do Kodak, Blockbuster, and Borders all have in common? And the answer is that they're all bankrupt. So these were companies, well-known brands, as well-known as any of our university brands, that were not able to deal with the technology disruption, who thought they knew more than their customers did, and they could tell their customers what to do. So something to think about. I call these the three amigos for what happened to them together. So there's some interesting developments going on. There's a project called the Minerva Project, which proposes to create a top-tier for-profit research universities. But unlike the University of Phoenix or Strayer, the students are going to live together on different campuses around the world, and top professors are expected to stream online classes to student seminars. An interesting and different model than what we're used to. Georgia Tech has announced a professional online Master of Science degree in computer science earned through MOOCs, sponsored at least in part by AT&T and offered through Udacity, which is one of the three major MOOC providers, Udacity, edX, and Coursera being the gang of three. They estimate program tuition at about $7,000 for the three-year coursework, and they expect to enroll 10,000 students at any given time, maybe 6,000 or so going for credit for the degree itself. Now, if you think about this number, it's a fraction of what a student living on campus in the MS and computer science program would pay for the same degree. One of the issues with MOOCs is being sure that the person who takes the course is actually the person who registered for it. And so Georgia Tech has made arrangements with 4,500 centers around the world for proctoring exams in order to give college credit for this degree. So here's Coursera. These are some courses on Coursera. Here is my favorite one, which is the one that I taught in March of this year. And for those of you who are interested in surviving disruptive technologies, the course is going to be offered again starting on September 30th. 10 public universities, maybe you are from some of these universities, are forming a partnership with Coursera. They plan to blend online materials from Coursera with faculty-led classroom sessions. Some of the schools will offer credits who take the courses online and then take a proctored exam. So what we're seeing here is a pattern of rapid growth among MOOCs and their acceptance for more than just a free course for students who are interested in a topic, but really now a situation where colleges would be using the MOOCs for credit in one way or another. So a question that I have is, are MOOCs, online and blended courses, a threat to American higher education? And interesting to see the results are coming in. And a substantial number of people look like they're saying they're not a threat. Well, I have colleagues in the marketing department in the business school. I'm in the Smith School of Business. And they always describe threats as really being opportunities. And so what we're talking about now, some people may see as a threat, and others may see as an opportunity. My concern is that not enough people see MOOCs either way. And so I would say, in my own belief, at least talking to university officials, I want to say they're a threat because I hope that they will take action to do something about them. Okay. Diana mentioned the survivor model. This came from some research in a book that I published last year called The Search for Survival, Lessons from Disruptive Technologies. Okay. I apologize. I would love to have you buy the book, but I made a mistake, and I didn't self-publish it, so the publisher put an outrageous price on it. It is available as a Kindle download for a little bit less, but this is the model that drives the book. It suggests that there's an innovator out there who has a new product or service or a new business model, and that's a transformational technology in use. And then we have the people we often don't look at, the incumbent. And the incumbent has to respond to this new disruptive technology. And here are listed some factors which inhibit that response. I applied this mostly to business organizations, but there is a chapter in the book about universities. And in fact, that chapter is probably too conservative now with what's happened in the last year since the book has been published. I think there are many people, at least at my own university, who are in a little bit of denial about the ability of online education to change what we do in academia. We certainly have resistance to change. I had a lot of resistance in my own mind to doing MOOCs and teaching online. Universities work very hard to promote their brands. We have huge sunk costs in campuses and buildings and athletic stadiums and so on. And so we, I think, have a number of these factors that inhibit our reaction, or at least the reaction of some people in the university, to this technological disruption. And the outcomes of the model really are threefold. One is to morph your business model. And that's kind of a happy outcome because you're able to change what you're doing to incorporate the new technology. In some instances, you've got to adopt a whole new business model, and that's really hard. And, of course, the last option is what happened to our friend, the Three Amigos, and that is they went out of business. Kodak does exist now, but it's only a matter of time before it disappears. So I guess a question that might be in your mind is whether or not you can successfully take a wait-and-see approach to MOOCs and online education. Can you sit back and let edX and other organizations try this out and see what happens? And I'm struck both with these responses, which is good, but I suppose you're all in EDUCAUSE, which makes you aware of and think about the technology. I was on a university committee looking at blended and online education and MOOCs, and an English professor on that committee said, well, can't we just wait 2 years and see what happens and then decide what the University of Maryland should do? Fortunately, that was not the view that dominated, and I certainly agree with this vote. I think that the time for action is doing something now. I think if we wait 2 or 3 years, as one of my colleagues put it, the train will have left the station, be so far down the tracks that we won't have an opportunity to catch it. Okay. Okay, so what's the online world like in teaching? There's a traditional course which we have offered in universities for a couple of hundred years. I've been teaching them for almost my entire teaching career. And then we have fully online courses. Okay? And there are two components to a fully online course. There's the asynchronous component and the synchronous component. Until about 2 or 3 years ago, I was opposed to online education because I felt it lacked a great deal of what I went into teaching for, which was contact with students. I enjoy the classroom give and take. I enjoy discussing case studies with my students and current events that impact the businesses and the business processes that we talk about in a business school. But I saw a few years ago, and it actually turned out, though I didn't know at the time, to be Adobe Connect, a live class held using this technology, which means that you can have a window for each student and the faculty member with live video. And while it's a little bit less fluent than a physical classroom, while the technology gets in the way a little bit, it's still possible to have an interactive class and discussions with your students. And that's a synchronous part of a class. The asynchronous part is the video lectures. For the most part, the MOOCs are asynchronous. You look at material at your convenience that's been recorded and posted for you on a website. And then there's something that's called blended. And I think blended is one of the really great things that we can do on our existing physical campuses. A blended course is one in which the physical class meeting still takes place. Students and instructor are in the same room. But the lecture material goes to the video lectures that are posted offline for people to look at through the internet. And this sometimes blended is used to say that the lecture is dead. I think that's very likely to be the case. I can't imagine students in 10 years who've grown up with the internet all around them expecting to see a man or a woman standing up on a stage in a room that holds 250 or 300 students delivering a lecture. I just think that will be such a foreign experience to them that they'll react quite negatively to it. And then the last form of the online world is obviously the MOOC. Okay, so my confessions as someone who's taught a MOOC. If you're thinking about doing this, think very carefully. There's an intensive development effort. I did not keep track of the hours I spent developing this course. I would suspect that it was well in excess of 100 hours. I had to create video lectures. I adopted the Coursera recommended platform, and I had a number of emails from people while I was offering the MOOC asking me what I had used. This is my home computer setup. You can see up here at the top is the traditional monitor with a PowerPoint slide up on it. Down here is something called a Wacom tablet. And I took the recommended Coursera configuration because I didn't have a lot of time to start preparing the course. There may be less expensive and there may be solutions that work better than this, but this worked quite well. What this setup allows me to do is you'll notice that the tablet duplicates what's on the monitor. So on the tablet, I have a pen, which is more precise than the one I'm using on my notebook computer now for this presentation. And the pen allows me to annotate things that appear exactly as I annotate them on the PowerPoint slide. So it's not a matter of trying to pick out where you want to underline something or circle something. It also lets you annotate with words, so I can write on the slides with the pen. The system I'm using now doesn't do that very well. So it's a Wacom tablet. I use Camtasia for editing, and I only used a small part of the features in Camtasia. I really didn't want to become an expert with it. I've also been asked about the process of doing this and how you can use it, and so I created a video lecture for our own faculty on how you might use this setup to teach from a PowerPoint slide, or how, if you're teaching a quantitative course, you could use it to enter equations. If you're interested in that, I've given the URL here for it, or if you download the PowerPoint slides and run them, you can just click on the link. I also had a lot of help in this course. I had two great teaching assistants. The first of these is a very good friend of mine named Frankie. Frankie is there with his favorite reading that he wanted me to recommend to all the students. And when I started each topic, I had two topics a week, I held Frankie up to the camera and I tried to explain to him an overview of what we were going to be talking about. And if you have to explain something to a dachshund, it has to be pretty simple, so you can at least get the audience acclimated to the topics that you're going to be covering. I also had a human teaching assistant named Danielle Wong, who looked at the discussion boards for me. The discussion boards were extremely active, and when you think about it, if you've got thousands of students, it only takes a few to be active to have a very rich set of discussions going on. And Danielle would monitor those discussion boards and let me know if there was some place where it would be appropriate to jump in and offer a comment. We also did a Google Hangout each week of the 7-week course, and Danielle would look at people who were active on the discussion board and then compile a list of names to invite to be a part of the Google Hangout. I used peer grading because my seminar was not a quantitative one, or my course was not a quantitative one. Peer grading worked all right. There were some problems with it for the round two of the course. I've making some changes that I think will make it go more smoothly. And I should say, in truth in advertising, what I offered was really more of a seminar. I only had 16,000 students who registered for it. Some of the MOOCs go into the 80, 90,000 or even over 100,000 students. One of the things that I found gratifying was the extremely positive response I had from students. Maybe it's because there are so many that just if a few like you, it seems really great. Near the end of the course, the students opened a discussion topic called Thank You, Hank. I had two postcards from overseas and a letter with thank yous. Those of you who have taught know that doesn't happen very often in our regular classes. Okay, so these are some statistics that our associate provost put together looking at all of our MOOCs. My course appealed to more professionals. If you look at the orange down here, I had more professionals who were involved, I think because of the nature of the topic. 72% indicated that they'd been affected by a technological disruption. The age of the people involved was older than the typical MOOC. I had fewer students, more professionals. The youngest was 13, the oldest was 80. I think the 80-year-old was actually the second dean to give me a job. We corresponded via email. He's retired and trying to stay active intellectually by taking MOOCs. The email addresses suggested 35 countries. There was a pre-course survey where people were asked about where they lived, and I went through that and kind of counted almost 100 countries involved. 70% from outside of the U.S., which is fairly common. Average length of time spent during a visit to the site was 38 minutes. Now, this is kind of interesting. MOOCs are criticized for their high dropout rates, and I have to say that doesn't bother me at all, because I would like to think that someone who watched two video lectures knows more at the end than when they started. As long as MOOCs are free, if we're talking about that kind of an experience, then let students view what they want to. Let the participants see and do the parts they would like. This graph is of the students and the percentage from the prior week that attended the next week. So we started out, I guess she found 18,000. I only found 16,000. About half of them were active. You can see that after the first week, we were down 62%, and then each week after that, we retained about 85% of the prior week's time. The number who submitted the assignments, you can see, were under 1,000 of the group. And again, we're not talking about this course being for credit. If I'm Georgia Tech offering a master's degree, then we would be more concerned about dropouts. Okay, so a question for you. The most resistance for moving to MOOCs and blended and online learning will come from students, the administration, or the faculty? And this is really quite an interesting question because I have seen this come from all three sets, but I'm kind of curious about which one is going to be the strongest in resisting all of this. And I can see that I and my faculty colleagues are taking a big hit on this. As it turns out, I think you're right. Okay, I think that I have seen more resistance from faculty than anyone else, but it's not, they're not alone. Some of our students, particularly students in physical classes, are concerned that we might be lowering the quality of their degree. The Smith School of Business is going to start an online MBA program in January. We will be having simultaneous synchronous sessions using Adobe Connect. We will have asynchronous work. We'll have a residence period in the beginning and the end, and that's upset some of our current students. Some of the administration is very much with it and is promoting and pushing MOOCs and other kinds of online teaching. Some of them, I think, are being a little too timid. There's a real reluctance to invest money in this, and there is no way to convert your classes into blended courses or to offer MOOCs without investing capital in that process. And then, of course, I think you're right that the faculty is very concerned about the kind of changes that are going to be required for us to succeed in this new world of online education. Okay, so we have a threat, but as we said, we also have an opportunity. MOOCs and online education are changing the structure of higher ed. If you look at the cost structure that's involved with a MOOC, it's very different from the cost structure of our current physical campuses. We have a tendency to look at this from a very parochial and kind of a selfish notion. What's going to happen to me as a faculty member? What's going to happen to my university? But it's a tremendous opportunity for students, not just on our campuses, but all over the world. I had emails coming back from students abroad saying, thank you so much. I would never have had the opportunity to take a course like this if it weren't for the internet and it weren't for MOOCs. So it's a tremendous opportunity to raise the level of global education. And I think we have to do some work to convince our universities that our purpose is not just serving students in the state of Maryland or even students in the United States, but we are an educational institution. And if we can change the life of somebody in Kenya or Rwanda or Iraq, then it's very much worth doing. So we can expand our scope and our educational mission. What this does do is raise the level of competition among schools. In the past, we've competed on athletic fields. We've competed to attract students to be freshmen at our schools, but now we're going to compete at the level of individual courses. Students, and sometime in the not-too-distant future, are going to come to the administration and say, I know that Professor Lucas offers a course on disruptive technologies, but here's a course that's offered at UC Berkeley. I think it's better. I want to take it as a MOOC. Why can't I do that? And so some of the faculty concern is that we will lose students that way. Some of the concern is, am I going to become a teaching assistant for a star professor on video? Am I going to be a subordinate to a Nobel Prize-winning economist who's giving a lecture course on MOOCs? And so the question for us, I think, is how do we add value as instructors? We do more than present material. We organize courses. We decide what material should be in the course. We prepare reading lists, exams, lectures, all kinds of things. And presenting it is only a small part of what we do. So we have to think about how we can add value in that process. So I guess to me, the main message I would like to get across is that we have to morph our business model and become more competitive and innovative in what we do. We have to innovate all the time, and we have to compete on quality. The only way that I can retain my students is to offer a course that they really want to take and that compares well with that course from UC Berkeley or wherever that course is being offered. We have to provide a variety of ways for students to sample and to take our courses and to be a part of our university. All of this is providing tremendous flexibility for students. If I go back to our three amigos, they tried to tell customers what they wanted. We've been telling students for many years what they can do. Now we've got to provide many more options and let them choose. And finally, for university administrators, can you do more to support online? Can you change the cost model of the university and allocate resources to online, maybe away from some of the physical things we've been doing? More than anything, I would like to try to create a sense of urgency. I think first movers are going to have a big advantage these days. We need to have the spirit of innovation. We have to support faculty and do some hand-holding as we transition to new modes of teaching. And we have to take action sooner than later. And we have to execute all of this successfully. You know, Kodak, Blockbuster, and Borders all had plans, and they all took actions to meet the technology disruption that was affecting them. But they weren't able to execute those plans successfully. And we've all seen the results of that. So I think in summary, we do live in very interesting times. MOOCs and other types of technologically enhanced students learning create great opportunities for both our students and for our institutions. But along with that comes challenges and threats. I think schools that compete vigorously with faculty who figure out how to add value to their courses will survive and flourish in this new world of blended and online and MOOCs education. So thank you very much. I'd be happy to take a few questions now, Diane.
Thanks, Hank. Lots of questions and lots of dialogue. Let me zero in for the few minutes that we've got on maybe some business model type of questions, because one of the things that I think people are concerned about is how expensive it is to offer a MOOC. You had shared with us the amount of time you spent on your MOOC, and there are questions, I guess, really about where this is going to go in the future. Can universities afford to offer MOOCs without charging for them? What about MOOCs undercutting our current revenue model, where you take a MOOC somewhere else and you get that credit at a different institution? What about all those articulation agreements and state authorizations? So where do you think it's going to go? A few people are offering MOOCs, but how do we afford to do this, particularly if you can't charge for credit?
Okay. Well, again, MOOCs are about a year old phenomenon right now, and the model is still evolving. It's going to change. No, we can't keep providing free material to edX and Coursera and Udacity. So there'll have to be a compensation model. Coursera is licensing some of its MOOCs to schools and then giving a royalty back to the school to develop the MOOC. They are offering an employment service. I don't know how well that's working right now. If you agree as a student and are looking for a position, they'll submit information to or allow employers to search their database for a fee. And they've also started a signature series where you can pay something for a certificate. I believe it's proctored in some way. So there will be revenue models. Daphne Kohler, who is a co-founder of Coursera, was at Maryland last spring and talked about it. And I think there's no question, at least Udacity and Coursera are funded with venture capital, and so those capitalists are going to expect a return. I think universities can't afford not to, because what's going to happen in this scenario is the student is going to want to take a MOOC from a different school, and you'll want to have a positive balance of payment. You want students taking your MOOCs from other schools as well, so that you're not continually paying royalties to other schools for their MOOCs with no income coming into you.
So one final very quick question before we move on to Eric, and that is, are there any new pedagogical approaches that we should be learning about from MOOCs?
Definitely. I think we have an issue with exactly how do you present material. I've said the lecture is dead, but the content of the lecture isn't dead. So if you go to the MOOC that I created with the setup that I showed in one of the slides, I appear in a video window, a small video window on one corner of the screen, and then there are PowerPoint slides that I annotate and underline. That's only one model. You can also go to a professional studio and have someone recorded lecturing to a either empty classroom or to a full classroom and convert that into the MOOC format. So we're really beginning to learn what is an appropriate format for watching asynchronous lectures and also for how to bring some interactivity to them. So the Google Hangouts did that for my MOOC, but only for 8 or 10 students at a time. The others had to be watching. They couldn't be participating directly.
Well, obviously, lots of interesting dialogue. We'll try to come back to some additional questions. Many of you are asking pretty fundamental questions about, well, you know, is this just about MOOCs or blended learning, online learning? We'll hope to come back to that, as well as questions about competency and credit and the like. So, Hank, thank you very much. And again, you are seeing the visual representation. We're trying to show you visually how the notes might flow from this. So I'm going to turn now to Eric Grimson, as I mentioned, from MIT. And Eric, will you share your perspective with us?
Absolutely, Diana. So first of all, let me thank EDUCAUSE and Diana for giving me an opportunity to speak today. I want to briefly address the topic of how MOOCs, or especially SPOCs, and if you haven't heard that term, it's not a Star Trek character, it's a small private online course, can interact with the traditional residential educational experience to lead to a strengthening of learning and education on those campuses. As a quick background, like Hank, I've taught a MOOC. I had 95,000 students start out from all but 3 countries in the world. I was missing only Svalbard, French Guiana, and the Falkland Islands. So, you know, it gives you an interesting perspective on how you want to teach. I want to start with some, I know they're going to be obvious statements, but let me start with some obvious statements for you. As Hank has already said, higher education, I think for many of us, is facing a tsunami of change and challenge. And the question is whether it's going to swamp institutions or whether we're going to be able to use it to improve learning. And I want to stress on improving learning because I think that's a key factor in what we want to try and do. I think there are 3 factors that are combining, creating a confluence that's causing this to happen. Again, probably obvious to many of you, this generation of students are very different in how they learn than previous generations. They're coming at us at a time when online tools are giving us a really broad array of different opportunities to change how we deliver and especially how we interact with those students. And in conjunction with that, the students especially are used to a very different mode of communication. And so one of the questions I think we want to wrestle with is how do we turn this into an opportunity to create a connection with our students that's simply different than what we've done in the past. Let me very briefly sort of highlight each of those. Again, an obvious statement, this generation of students are different from previous generations. I've listed a set of examples of places where they are. For us here at MIT, we see students come in with very diverse interests and backgrounds than what they had in the past, with a much more global perspective, which means not only do they want to have impact on the global stage, they are as likely to be spending time in different parts of the world while participating at MIT, and we want to keep them connected to campus. They're very entrepreneurial. They're incredibly socially aware, and especially they're mobile and wired. And I often say wired is both electronic and caffeinated. Perhaps you've experienced that as well. But that mobility and that being connected is something that gives us an opportunity to think about how we should teach them. As Hank said, you know, how have we taught in the past? Well, we all do this. It's been around actually for centuries, probably 8 or 9 centuries. It's the lecture format. It's passive readings. It's problem sets in laboratories where the student may get feedback 3 weeks, 4 weeks after they turned it in, which is just clearly not effective to the learning experience. And the same thing with essays. I'm sure you've had this experience. I love the picture in the top right of the lecture hall, because if you look carefully, what do you see? Students sleeping, students texting, students checking their Facebook, students cleaning their nails on their feet. I'm not certain what that says about MIT students, but there you go. A few of them paying attention, but it's a passive one-way transfer. And we need to think about how MOOCs and SPOCs can really change that. part of that is coming from the technology trend. And as Diana said when we started this, if you think about it, a student today, in principle, can view lecture material and other material online anywhere, anytime. They can do it on a tablet, on a laptop, they can do it on their phone. With the right kinds of use of technology, they ought to also be able to interact with tutors online on their schedule. Those tutors might be our graduate TAs, but those tutors might also be automated systems that are providing them with instantaneous feedback. And of course, students can pose questions and discuss issues remotely at any time. When I've taught on-campus courses, I'll often monitor our online system for dealing with student feedback. And it's fascinating to see, at least here in Cambridge, the peak hour for posing questions is between 1 and 3 o'clock in the morning. Don't ask what I'm doing up at 1 and 3 o'clock in the morning, but that's when students are posing questions. And we need to think about how we interact with them to make sure that we answer those questions. I want to show you a slide that, really to me drives home how quickly the technology is changing. I've borrowed this from some images that are available freely on the internet. Perhaps you've seen these. Both are taken in St. Peter's Square. The top image is from 2005. I believe it is when John Paul II's body was brought out for public viewing. And the bottom image, only 8 years later, is when Pope Francis made his first public appearance. And all you have to do is look at that image to realize what an incredible difference in technology and what students around the world are capable of using in terms of online technology. So how do we use this to really make an impact? Well, I'm going to give you my cut on this. Everybody's got a different version. That picture in the top right is a god-awful picture of me doing a MOOC. Students didn't complain too badly about it, so I guess that's just the way I look. But here are, I think, many of the components of what you'd have in a MOOC, and you could also have in a SPOC. And I wanted to highlight some factors on three or four of them. Clearly, you can take video sequences and replace lectures, but I think a key factor is to break the video of the lecture up into small size chunks. A lot of good learning specialists will tell you 5 to 8 to 10 minute chunks are the right size to try and get across a concept. And as I'm going to say in a second, I think it's great to interleave those video snippets with what we called finger exercises. You can see the list. You've got access to online textbooks and readings, but you also have an opportunity to let students proactively interact with laboratories, simulation-based laboratories, virtual laboratories, and in some cases actually controlling remotely physical laboratory equipment to run experiments. I think the interactive assessments is a key factor, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time on that. And as Hank said, the discussion forums can be a fascinating way to see not only how students are learning, but to amplify the learning of all of our students. So I want to show you some examples of that. Before I do it, I want to leave one last piece, and I'm going to jump into this, and that is, if the MOOCs are here, then why should we have a residence-based education? And I can tell you from my institution, we very firmly believe that we want to use these tools to enhance what happens for our students here in 02139 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm not going to dwell on this. You can read it. But I would suggest here are four points that I think are crucial to how we want to use online tools to strengthen a residential-based experience. One is to use it to help contribute to that intense intellectual atmosphere that students benefit from. They learn from debate, competition, collaboration, exploration, not just from a dry delivery of knowledge. And we ought to be able to use blended and flipped and other models to enhance that. I think they learn by seeing problems in context, and I think we can use online tools to help provide that context. You can see the other two key points here, and I'd leave you with, before we jump into the details, to me at least, a major factor in thinking about how we're going to use online tools. And that is, I'm sure many of you would agree, a really strong education is not just about acquisition of knowledge. It's about acquisition of perspectives, of problem-solving skills, of tools that let you collaborate to create solutions. And a good use of online tools should amplify that. So this is listed as a poll. It's really not a poll. It's really two questions that I would invite you to contribute in the chat space, which is, can we use MOOCs or SPOCs to enhance the connection between faculty and students and between the residents' experience and the global community? And I'm going to try and give you a sense of that. And then, can we use MOOCs or, again, especially SPOCs, to facilitate educational change? And how can we use them to improve learning rather than just automating it? The automation's nice, but really what we want to do is, I think, as Hank said, think about our customer, which is, how do they learn? I want to show you, I think, five places where, in our experience, we've found the online tools to be tremendously valuable. And while they are valuable in MOOCs, they are valuable in other settings. And I'll start with the idea of immediate feedback. We'd launched here at MIT, actually almost 12 years ago, a course which in some sense became an early version of a MOOC, where we put all of our lectures for a major introductory course online, and we simply focused on interacting with the students. One of the things we did is we inserted what we called finger exercises in between the small video segments. So a 50-minute lecture might be five segments, and in between most of those 10-minute segments, we'd put in a short question. The idea was it should be quick to answer, but it gives the student a sense of, have I actually understood what's being talked about? And if I haven't, maybe I should go back and re-listen to this segment again, or maybe I should go and find some other place in the material to look at other things I want to look at. It's turning the learning process into what I hope is a more active kind of process. When we did an assessment on this, again, almost 10 years ago, we found that for the students, this was a tremendously useful thing because it gives that immediate feedback. It keeps them engaged. And the feedback we even see now in MOOCs, where we track where students go, and that leads to a second place where you can use this. It gives you information about gaps in a student's mastery of the material, looking at when do they go back and look at other pieces, when do they do the reset, if you like, gives you really valuable information. For this to work, you need assessment tools. Many of them are going to be automated. There are a lot of nice things coming along. But as Hank said, peer assessment can also be a really interesting way to provide some of that feedback. It can't be as immediate, but it does provide that opportunity. And one of the things that is really nice here is that you can use this to direct students to the discussion forum, that if they are really struggling with mastering something, you can pop up a window that says, you might want to go and talk this over with other classmates to decide what is going to work here. Having said that, I think a question we all have to face is, will this work for all disciplines? My concern is there are going to be some disciplines for which this is really more of a struggle than I would like. My particular field of computer science, it's easier to see how we can do that. But we're already seeing in the big MOOC providers a pretty wide range of ways in which we can do this. But a question for you is, to what extent is this going to work and what disciplines are going to really struggle with it? There's a second place, though, where that automated assessment can be, on my mind, tremendously valuable to an instructor, and we've used it a lot here at MIT, which is we'll still bring our students back into a class for what we call a recitation section, an interaction of 20 students in a session. By mining the data online of what they have done with the lectures and the finger exercises and the online problem sets, an instructor gets a dashboard that can say, for example, I don't need to spend much more than 3 minutes of summary on this topic because 95% of my students have nailed it. But they are really struggling with this concept, so I'm going to focus my time on that. I understand a clicker system can do that as well, but this gives the faculty member some prep time, which I think is really good in terms of guiding how do I get a model of my students and dealing with it. And the second one, again, is mining that data to illustrate where are there gaps in the presentation of a concept. I used this in my own MOOC when I went and looked at where were the places where students tried to answer a question multiple times. Because it made me go back and look at, did I explain that concept in that video segment the way I wanted to or not? And I hope this is part of an early stage of just improving the learning, that we as instructors can learn from the online tools how our students are learning by actually looking at what the data tells us about this. So that automated assessment, when we have it, is valuable to the students because of the feedback, but it's tremendously valuable to us as instructors. As Hank already said, there is a tremendous opportunity for dealing with discussion here. And I have to tell you, when I started off with 95,000 students, I was shuddering thinking about how am I going to deal with the questions. But the online forum has a couple of great opportunities. One is one can easily, and many of the MOOC providers have done this, structure the forum so that you let students vote up questions. And so I could go to my MOOC and say, oh, 200 or 300 or in some cases 1,000 students have said this is a great question. I want to answer that one. The second piece of it, though, is that you let the students interact. And I know many of my colleagues have said, truth is not a democracy. I agree. But you know what? Collective intelligence is pretty impressive. You can see students answering each other's questions. And you as an instructor can go in and reinforce really good answers. In fact, in some of the systems, you can give those students extra credit. And in my most recent version of the MOOC I've been teaching, we elevated some students to, if you like, community TAs because they gave great answers. One of the advantages is for the students actively engaged, if you think about it, they are strengthening their learning experience by explaining it to other students. And yes, there's a chance they'll head off on a bad track and your TA or you have to come and bring them back in. But you can really do, as Hank suggested, that directed discussion on the key points and let the forum really go. I'm going to come back to the discussion in a second because I think there's some other places where this is tremendously valuable. But I think discussion forums are a really big opportunity here. You also have the opportunity to do visualizations, and we've done a number of these things. I'm simply going to point them out, that letting students control simulation drives home the learning in a much better way, and this is an example from one of the physics classes we taught here at MIT. But I think those tools are going to improve a great deal. And I think another place where you're going to do it or have great opportunity is with simulations. This is actually from a course taught by our provost, Chris Kaiser, on genetics, where students do those fruit fly experiments online. It doesn't teach the lab skills, and I want to acknowledge it, but it lets students explore spaces in really interesting ways because they can very quickly go in and run simulations to understand why different things would work in different directions. And I think over the next few years, we're going to see a growth of these kinds of simulation tools in a wide range of disciplines, which is going to be really valuable. There's another place where I think the discussion forum can be tremendously useful, and I want to spend just a minute on this. And that is, imagine teaching not a MOOC, but a restricted MOOC. And by that I mean you're teaching a class on campus, but you have perhaps a few thousand other participants. Imagine you're teaching a class on climate change. The dynamic of the discussion in your own classroom can be great. But think about what the dynamic of that discussion could be if it is also joined by people from Central Africa, Central China, Central Asia, other places where they think about this very differently. We taught a class here at MIT on the economics of the developing world where we tried to do that. But my favorite example is from our great sister institution here in Cambridge, a course taught as a MOOC in copyright law by a Harvard law professor where he restricted the outside class to 5,000 students. And had a controlled discussion within that framework. That, I think, can create a tremendously valuable experience for our own students, that they have to talk about what does it mean to think about copyright, where you're debating it with people coming from very different backgrounds. I think this is a place where we'll see SPOCs and MOOCs having an opportunity to really think about changing the way we talk about dialogue and discussion. So I'm going to ask you to think then about a quick poll. On a scale of 1 to 10, to what degree do you feel that you could use an online campus program to personalize the way your students are going to have a learning experience? And I'm going to talk about that in a second. But this ought to be one of the advantages for a student, is to really let them tune the online experience to the way they think, the way they learn, the way they want to explore technology. And I can see as I look at this, we're all over the map, which is okay. I think it's going to be a real range of opportunities here. I'm going to let this settle down. But, you know, the weight of it is a little bit on the higher end that we're going to be able to do some of that. Okay, I'm going to let that just settle in for a second. But let me, in fact, if I can then move on to the next slide, if we could move past that. So what are the places where I think we could do personalized learning? And I'm going to violate a copyright right now. But imagine, I think there will be an opportunity to mine the online data to create the equivalent of Amazon.edu. And by that I mean, if you look at how students online answer questions, you ought to be able, and in fact you can already do this, bring up hints that say, did you know that other students who struggled with answering this question went to this place in the reading, went to this particular video lecture, went to these kinds of places to try and get information to answer that. We've already seen some of that here at MIT, that you can use the data from thousands of students answering things to extract typical solutions, which you can then use to map to an individual student to give them nudges as to how they might want to think about this problem. Students who approach this problem in this way use the following additional information. I think you can link it to misconceptions. You can link it to material for exploration. I think it's in early stages, but I think it's an opportunity that's going to be really of interest. And the last question I'm going to leave for you is, before I give you my own view on this, is how can as I say, has online learning be taken into consideration when you think about what you do with your own campus space? And again, I just ask you to put some thoughts up on here. It's not really a poll. It's, if you like, just an opportunity to provide some insight. But I'm going to skip by this to go to the next slide, if I can have that cleared, because I want to give you a sense of this. Here at MIT, for example, we're asking the following classroom, the following question. Do we need lecture halls that seat 700? Or, in fact, do we want to think of a classroom as something that is a smaller space that can be easily reconfigured, but, in fact, that the students are going to do a lot of that classroom experience in their dorm room, in their fraternity, in their sorority, and when they do come to class, it's in smaller settings? Is chalk and talk still relevant, or is it going away? Second question we're wrestling with here is, what does the dormitory of the future look like? Should it include explicitly spaces for exploration, for collaboration, for remote access, acknowledging that students will do a lot of their learning in those spaces with small groups, and when we bring them into the experience with the faculty member, it's going to be in those small kinds of settings? These are examples of questions I think that institutes of higher learning have to think about, because this tsunami is coming at us, and if we don't change, we may find ourselves really a little bit underwater as we try and think about it. So as I suggested when I started, I think today's students are a different generation of learners, much more comfortable with social media, with interacting with students and other colleagues in that setting, much more comfortable about viewing material anytime, anywhere. So those online tools are going to change the game. They are changing the game, but I think we can use it as an opportunity to leverage those new modes of communication to create more personalized experiences for our students. And Diana, with that, I will let you fire a couple of questions at me.
We've had terrific discussion. People have really appreciated the way that you've framed things. And I guess what I'd like to do, Eric, is go back to maybe the beginning question that we framed the whole webinar around, and that is how technology might impact pedagogy, and ask you, as a computer scientist, to talk about what kinds of emerging technology might be coming next, and where we might be looking for new enabling technologies that change some of the pedagogies. You've given us great ways of enhancing residential learning and where online tools are available. What do you see next with those emerging technologies?
Boy, Diana, it's a great question because I'm really bad at crystal ball gazing. But I'm going to give you two examples that I think hold a real potential to change the way we think about pedagogy. One is what I said at the end. I'm just going to repeat it, but I want to highlight it. And that is, I know from my own experience, I know there are many people on this webinar who are also very experienced with teaching, students learn in different ways. We try to do a one-size-fits-all delivery of material to students, and it will work for the majority of them, but it won't capture all of them. So I think as we have the opportunity to think about personalizing the experience, it's going to change the pedagogy. So an example I would give you is some students are much more visually oriented in terms of how they learn. Others are more auditory oriented. Others are more, and I'm sure there are better examples that education specialists could give me. But I think that we could imagine creating flipped or blended experiences where students learn the material, access the material in different ways, and we have to think from a pedagogical perspective, how do we capture the same knowledge, the same ideas, but present them in different ways so that students can find the mechanism by which they can best actually learn. The second quick one that I would say, it's a more of a tool, but I think it's going to be fascinating to watch, is, as I said earlier on, there's a real question of can you use these assessment tools in all disciplines? And one that I would expect many people to raise is, what do you do about essays? And there's early stages of using tools to take a combination of peer assessment, but especially sort of machine learning tools to start creating templates of what constitutes a good short answer, 250-word essay question. It is not perfect, but I've already seen some assessment data comparing performance of those tools against humans, and it's surprising how well it will go. And if that is available to us in another year or two as a great tool for assessing that kind of input from students, I think it opens up the question for what does that do to change our pedagogy. I don't have the answer, but I think it's a great way of thinking about it. And I've already seen a number of colleagues do this well. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how it changes things.
Wonderful. And one final question, and that is to ask you if you can speak about the accessibility implications of online learning. Any thoughts there?
Can you give me a sense of what you mean by accessibility, Diana? You mean just generally for people of different, people who have particular challenges?
Yes, yes. There wasn't more detail in that question from the audience, but I assume that we're talking about students who have various forms of disabilities.
Yeah. I think that's a fabulous question. To be honest, I'm not enough of an expert to really know how best we could do it, but I have to believe that these tools could be tuned towards that. A great question. I just don't have a good answer to it.
Great. And maybe one more quick question. It was fascinating to watch you show different tools for providing immediate feedback, providing guidance to instructors, and EDUCAUSE looked at analytics last year. Any thoughts on what it takes to develop the kinds of dashboards that you've shown?
You can put as much effort or as little as you want into this, but I know when we built ours here 10 years ago, it was a pretty straightforward thing to do, and I would expect that the MOOC providers are going to provide this, if they haven't already, I know many of them have, to people who want to use them. And some of those MOOC providers are doing it open source, which means it will be available. So I think that it is really something that is going to be, it's fairly straightforward to do, I guess is the best answer I can give to you, Diana. I would say as well, by the way, I know in my own experience that having that feedback of what the students were doing was so valuable to me as I thought, not only how can I refine my lectures in the future, but what do I want to come back and pick up because I didn't do it right. And I think the more we can have those tools, just the better it's going to be for everybody using this.
Excellent. Eric, thank you so much. I've got a lot of questions. We'll let Susan tell us what's going on with e-learning and then come back to you all at the end of the program. Susan?
Great.
Thank you, Diana. Fascinating, Eric. And now I hope to give you all a little bit of grounding in the research data as we have done some exploring into e-learning. I'm going to talk with you about six topics today, overall interest in e-learning at our institutions and who benefits from e-learning and how, some data that we collected about delivering e-learning services, because I know that many of you are practitioners and trying to think this through, the challenges that we've experienced with e-learning, and then, of course, we will pause for a MOOC moment and take a little bit of a deep dive into our research on MOOCs, and then talking about how to make headway with e-learning and how to monitor and measure your headway. So let's start with a poll, because I said I was going to start with talking about the extent to which there's interest in e-learning. And so my poll question for you is a very simple one. Compared to last year, is there greater interest in e-learning on your campus? Yes, no, not sure. All right, great. So I think that you are definitely following the pattern of the data that we have found. So if we could close this poll, and I will talk with you about the data. 98% of our respondents, and these are CIOs and IT leaders at institutions, have said that e-learning is either a major interest for the institution or a major interest for some departments. And there are various motivations that they identified for exploring e-learning, to serve the post-traditional learner, economic issues, and purely to improve the quality of teaching and learning. So who does benefit from e-learning? Individuals benefit in a number of ways, and this is the results of some focus group interviews that we did with institutional leaders and folks involved in e-learning. We found that it provides increased flexibility, that students, both in the course offerings that they can take, their access to course materials, when, where, and how they take courses. It also helps faculty with with helping them improve and revitalize their teaching. We're finding, and I think this echoes some of the conversations earlier today, instructors and course designers have to spend more time to develop a structured, high-quality experience for students. And many of our focus group participants and faculty say that that is often transferred to their face-to-face courses. So what they do with online learning actually extends to what they're doing face-to-face and improves it. We're finding that people in the focus groups also said that they felt that it enhanced the learning experience, increased opportunities for collaboration among students. Eric just told you about learning analytics, and our focus group folks said that it's really wonderful to have that instant and useful feedback. And then a fourth benefit that folks identified was improved time to degree. So many of our participants said that they're helping students graduate faster by being able to take online courses. Now, how does the institution benefit? Our institutional leaders identified four primary institutional benefits. One was simply growth of enrollment, access to a greater population of students. Similarly, companion to that growth in enrollment, an increased or additional revenue stream. Many of them got into it and saw the benefit of enhancing their reputation. And then finally, being able to streamline their curricula and offer fewer versions of the same topic. So this gives you a little wordle of the results of our transcripts of our conversations and the benefits of e-learning. Now, let's talk a little bit about delivering e-learning services and what it's like for our friends at institutions who are trying to do this. You can see these charts at the bottom. The dark green bars tell you a little bit about dedicated e-learning centers. Some are separate from IT. Some are integrated in IT. And turns out having a dedicated e-learning center is an advantage when we related it to other data. Institutions with dedicated e-learning centers were more advanced in their e-learning initiatives or more mature, and we'll talk about e-learning maturity at the very end of this talk, and they were twice as likely to consider themselves e-learning leaders or innovators. Doctoral institutions, not surprising at all, are the most likely to have multiple programs, and for those of us who live and breathe central IT, central IT is involved in two-thirds of e-learning, which means that it's not involved in one-third of e-learning. Community colleges, we found, are e-learning leaders in the sense that they're most likely to have a dedicated e-learning center, and they're most likely to say that they offer, quote-unquote, a significant number of online classes, so more than a handful, more than a few. Everybody told us, no matter what type of institution they were at, that they need more staff. You can see it's 124% more, which sounds like a big number when you actually look at the y-axis on this graph. You know, people may have one staff and they say, we need one more. But the point is that people do not feel, institutions don't feel that they're at the optimal level. So who do they need in terms of staff for e-learning? This little quadrant graph, if you take a look at it, the green dots indicate that folks are saying, well, we have enough of those positions. Either we've got them and we don't need any more, or we don't have them but we don't see the need for them. The red ones are saying, in the upper right-hand quadrant, people are saying, well, we have them but we need more. Particularly course designers and professional development staff. Or there are new roles that institutions don't have that they do need, like graphic designers, videographers, application programmers. So how are we delivering? How are we managing e-learning services? And if you look at this list of e-learning services, this graph tells you both the extent to which these e-learning services are offered at various institutions. So, for example, you can see that about 50% of institutions have told us that they offer adaptive learning technologies. And then the dark green versus the light green give us a sense for whether these are offered by a central group, such as a dedicated e-learning center, central IT, student services, something like that, or they are distributed and offered by individual departments or multiple departments. one of the things that we found, so-called innovative services like open educational online resources, adaptive learning, gaming, and simulations are not only least common, but they're also most likely to be distributed. We found what is perhaps a gap with students in terms of the services they want and the services that our institutions are offering. And what we found is that what students most want more of, fewest institutions provide. I'm giving you results from a couple of studies. One is the ECAR study of online learning, and then the other is the ECAR study of undergraduate students and technology. So we mashed up the data from both of those studies, and we found that what students most want more of are open educational resources and gaming and simulations. Well, so the next question is, if there's a gap, do our institutions see it, and do they think that they need more staff and more resources in those areas? And it's not really clear that our institutions are understanding students' preferences in these areas, because you can see with the results, game designers, folks are saying, well, we don't have them, but we don't really need them either. And librarians, who arguably might be our best bet to help curate and identify open educational resources, we have enough in place, no more are needed. Outsourcing e-learning services. So again, you see the same set of services on the y-axis, but a different way to slice them. The average rate of outsourcing online services overall, which is the light green bar, is about 29% of our e-learning services are outsourced, but it really depends on the e-learning service, and very few institutions are outsourcing course delivery or technical support, project management. It is more common for e-portfolios and social networking and the learning management system. All right, e-learning challenges. What are the challenges that folks identified with regard to e-learning? Well, first of all, to start off, I should just say that some institutions are not offering e-learning at all. Their explanations are that they don't really think that it fits with their culture, their mission as an institution. That, I think, was what we heard most often. Either that, or that they don't have the financial resources or the technology. Lack of faculty interest was another one. So these are the things that are holding people back from offering them. We had one department chair, though, say an interesting thing, which is to say, well, we're not going into e-learning for undergraduate education, but we are exploring it with our master's program. And they're doing that really trying to bring their alumni back who may have relocated or they may work full-time. And so this is an opportunity for the alma mater to deliver a master's degree. Looking overall at the concerns that IT and institutional leaders and faculty identified regarding e-learning, you can see that most of the concerns are minor to moderate. Those are the two middle shaded green bars. There are some that are a little bit more staffing, technological know-how of faculty. And how does this look when we look at different types of institutions? Well, we found that smaller institutions are significantly more concerned about their ability to keep up with other institutions and about their faculty's ability to have the technological expertise to be able to deliver and design e-learning. Two-year institutions are least concerned about faculty skepticism, and private institutions are significantly more concerned than publics about faculty skepticism and the overall return on investment of e-learning. So they're looking at the bottom line. So what are the overall implications of e-learning, and where might we be headed? These issues that people surfaced, and these predictions, are based on focus group questions that we asked. And we had people say, for example, that they think that Online education often precludes hiring at the last minute. So, you know, in the traditional delivery of education, it's easy to kind of save everything for the last minute and to wait until just before you offer the course. Well, you can't really do that with online learning. And therefore, faculty involvement in the design of an online course can occur as much as a semester or more before the course begins. Another difference that people are predicting is online courses may be designed and offered on demand rather than in the traditional sequential model. There may be an increased demand at certain institutions for courses tailored to local economic and employment circumstances. So perhaps regional focuses and industries may affect the programs that are being offered at the institutions of higher education for regional online learning. The metrics for faculty workload may need to be updated or changed. And, you know, I think that you heard Eric and Hank talk about this, the degree of preparation that is required. Development of an online course requires a lot of more of an instructor's time. And we may find that faculty need incentives in form of a reduced workload, for example, or increased salary, especially when teaching online for the first time. Another issue is this need for 24/7 support. Eric said that the most questions that he got was between 1 and 3 a.m. So both pedagogical and IT support may need to gear up and ramp up for some form of 24/7 support. And then finally, academic leaders may also have to consider the impact of free course offerings on the academic mission and business model of their institution. And so some institutions are thinking maybe it'll make sense to offer some free courses, MOOC or non-MOOC, to students as a recruiting tool and to get students interested in certain programs. So those are some of the predictions. And now we will pause for the obligatory MOOC moment. And there's just something about MOOCs that cause people to come up with egregious puns and alliteration and just bad jokes in general, I guess. So I apologize for that. We looked at MOOCs both with regard to the student study and the e-learning study. And so I think some of the folks in the chat room made this distinction earlier on. Well, online learning and MOOCs are different. And indeed, our data certainly show that. When we look at the percent of undergraduates who say they're taking MOOCs versus online learning, you see a big difference. Similarly, with institutions delivering MOOCs versus online learning. And then finally, with institutional leaders' interest in MOOCs versus online learning. And in every way, online learning is both perhaps more flexible, there are more opportunities, and it's more accessible and more important in general to our institutions. So which institutions are offering MOOCs today? Overall, primarily MOOC creation, and this will not surprise you, I know, is primarily centered in large doctoral institutions. Those are the dark solid blue bars, and likely to remain so because these are the future plans, the light hashed blue bars. And so you can see that by far the action in MOOC offering is happening in those large research institutions. Well, why are institutions choosing whether or not to offer MOOCs? So these two bar charts give you both sides of the question. We asked institutions, well, why are you offering MOOCs? And then we also asked, well, why are you not doing MOOCs? And you can see that it really is a matter of strategy. Is this going to be our mission? Is this going to be our strategy for exploring, building our reputation, offering new faculty? Or is it not part of our mission? Explicitly not. Then there's also the risk issue. So some folks are saying, well, we're not going into MOOCs because they are a fad. So that's a big piece of it. Resources, you can see, is another big piece of it, particularly with regard to institutions who are not offering MOOCs. The business model is unproven in their eyes. And then, obviously, interest among leadership and faculty. And we all know with every big change initiative and strategic initiative that leadership is a requirement for it to succeed at an institution. Now, I told you that we have some data from the ECAR study of undergraduates in technology. And what was fascinating about this is we just all have MOOC fever, and we're talking about it. Seems like you can't, you know, read an issue of the Chronicle or the Times or whatever else you read to keep up with higher education and not hear something about MOOCs. Well, turns out that many of our undergraduate students are not aware of MOOCs. 3/4 of them were not familiar with MOOCs, and we gave them several definitions of MOOCs. So we really tried to jog their memories, and only 25% said they were familiar with it. And you know, you know, there's always a bias in surveys where people will try to say yes, even if they're not sure. So if anything, this may be over-reporting familiarity with MOOCs. And then the other smaller bars are also giving you an indication of who's taken a MOOC. So who's more likely to know about intake MOOCs? Men, students who are enrolled in private doctoral institutions. And remember, these are undergraduate students who we're talking about. So we're not talking about the whole population of MOOC students. Hispanics, whites, and others, so people who are not of Black and Asian ethnicity, but those folks who are more familiar with MOOCs. People over 25 and non-U.S., so Canada and other countries throughout the world. But which students complete MOOCs? We found women were more likely than men to complete MOOCs. Community college students more likely, even though, as you saw in the previous slide, students from private doctorals were more likely to know about and enroll in MOOCs. Blacks were more likely to complete MOOCs. People over 25, which was the same as those who are familiar with and take MOOCs. And people in the U.S., students in the U.S. and Canada were the undergraduate students who were more likely to complete MOOCs. The MOOC completion rate was about the same as I think Hank reported in his course, about 3%. So what's the value proposition? Well, first of all, for institutions, it's about exploring the business case. Many of them have noted that Moody's Investment Services has designated MOOCs as a credit positive for institutions who are offering them. And then we also had access to data of a select set of institutions that are offering MOOCs, major research institutions belonging to the Common Solutions Group. And in a poll that they took this spring, 45% of them are discussing the possibility of awarding credit, and 33% are considering monetizing their MOOCs. What's the value proposition for students? At this time, a little bit of data on that, and we find that around half of the students who have completed a MOOC report that they've received a digital badge for completing their MOOC, and only about half of the students overall, regardless of whether they took a MOOC or not, would actually use a badge or a digital certification in a job application. So badging is certainly an intriguing concept for the future, but the value proposition for badging, which is a primary value proposition for students for MOOCs at this time, is not front and center for students. So value proposition for students for MOOCs, perhaps still to be determined. And then finally, I'm just going to briefly tell you a little bit about our e-learning model. I'm very, very short on time, so I'm not going to go through all of these slides. But ECAR did with the e-learning study, we identified 7 different components of maturity in e-learning, and you can see those 7 different components here, and here's where higher ed stands today. Synergy of e-learning, that there's at least some centralized e-learning services. IT considers e-learning critical. There's reliable technology. The priority placed on e-learning, is it a strategic priority? Do we view it as an investment? Do we have senior positions from e-learning? Readiness, faculty interest, faculty determine the technology used, and we've got adaptable and scalable e-learning services, programs, and technologies. The next one is ongoing technology and evaluation and training. Do we have faculty training, new technologies regularly evaluated, and do we have both staff and student training in place? e-learning policies and governance, do we have those in place? Do we have security? Have we thought that through? Do we have policies for IP, for decision-making, for ID verification? And do we have governance for e-learning? And then investment in faculty and staff, is e-learning support straining IT or not? And are faculty rewarded for online courses? And then finally, outcomes assessment. Do we have analytics to evaluate strategic progress, and do we have sufficient analytics? So you can see this online. You can go to our site. And why does maturity matter? Well, we looked at maturity for institutions, and we found that more institutions that were more mature in e-learning, they expanded technology provisioning and support to meet the needs of the course and faculty. They have more staff and are more satisfied, and they have a dedicated e-learning center. So you can see that less mature institutions place the greatest emphasis on cost. So thank you very much, and I'll turn it back to you, Diana.
Thanks, Susan. Lots and lots of excellent information there. And there's been a question about intellectual property and MOOCs in a variety of different ways. Joan Chevry just posted a link to a brand new resource that we just released about copyright challenges in a MOOC environment. Please take a look at that. I think you'll find a wealth of information there. Susan and Eric, in just the couple of minutes that we have left, one of the topics we really haven't talked about that I want to ask you is about the new roles that are needed in this kind of environment to help us with this revolution in learning. Any thoughts about the new roles that we need?
So, Diane, I'll take a quick cut at that. I think we're still seeing this evolve, but, you know, I think there are a couple of examples where we're going to need it. One is something I didn't mention, I think it was probably on the chat here, is, you know, what's the role of the library systems and what do we need in terms of the librarians of the future to provide the kind of access students need when so much of the course material now is provided in this way is one place where I think we're really going to need it. The other new role is, it's been hinted at, not hinted at, it's been talked about, I think, in all three presentations, is that so much of the really successful delivery is going to depend on carefully designed, carefully created online tools. And that means that our IT systems are going to need a different kind of person to think about how do we create the tools that are going to make this go. It's a generic statement, but I think those are two places where it's going to matter. And frankly, I'd say for young faculty, having some experience with being able to use online tools is going to be an important part of your training as you think about becoming a faculty member.
Susan, anything that you'd like to add about roles?
I agree with Eric on those counts. I also think that as we do explore other modes of learning, that roles that haven't even occurred to us are going to be created. And what I always remember is my job did not exist when I entered the workforce. I think that there's plenty of new jobs, new roles, indeed perhaps entirely new professions that we're going to see spring up over the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
There are so many questions, very good questions, that I hope you all will continue to stay with us for the third day of the sprint, because we haven't yet talked about what our students need to know to be most effective, whether we're moving to a competency-based model, lots of different things. But a quick recap, again, our visual facilitation on your screen right now. We started out this afternoon talking about whether or not MOOCs are a threat, whether a threat can be motivating. We then turned to talking about SPOCs instead of MOOCs, small private online courses, and as someone commented in the chat, gee, imagine 5,000 as a small class. But lots of focus on how do we improve learning, and Eric shared with us five different places where online tools are valuable in providing immediate feedback, guidance to instructors, enabling different kinds of discussions, visualization, simulation, and engaging in a global conversation. So lots of ideas about what we can do with the pedagogy. Susan came back, shared with us lots of interesting data on e-learning, online learning, and a MOOC moment. shared with us information that students may not be as aware of this as we are or as people are in the popular media. So it's been a wonderful whirlwind. Hank, Eric, and Susan, thank you on behalf of our attendees, and thanks to all of you who have joined us this afternoon. Before you sign off, if we could ask you to please quickly click on the session evaluation link in the bottom right-hand corner of your screen, we'd love to get your comments. The session will be archived on the EDUCARS Sprint website, and that will include the slides, a webinar recording, as well as the visual notes. And throughout the week, we're posting videos, podcasts, and lots of other resources, so be sure to check the website often. And watch for the newsletter that outlines each day's themes and summarizes the daily activities. And please join us tomorrow, August 1st, again at 1 o'clock Eastern Time for Day 3 of the EDUCAUSE Sprint. Tomorrow we'll hear about creating the IT architecture for the connected age from three different CIOs, Tracy Schroeder from Boston University, Tracy Futhi from Duke University, and Ethan Benetton from Merrillhurst University. We hope to see you then, and right now, if you would join us on IdeaScale, which is our conversation hub for the sprint, we'll continue today's conversation. And remember, the EDUCAUSE Sprint is a production of EDUCAUSE, the Higher Education Technology Association. This is Diana Oblinger. Thanks for joining us for day 2 of the EDUCAUSE Sprint.